Welcome, friends, it's the Movie Boom Podcast. Enjoy the show. Zachie and Brian are talking about movies. Movie Boom Podcast on the radio.
Welcome to Movie Film. This is episode 125, brought to you by Mr. Boy Productions. My name is Zaki Hassan, and with me once again is my friend Brian Hall.
Hey, what's going on, Zaki?
Hey, Brian. You know, it's a little early, but I think it's okay to say this. Happy 5-year anniversary.
Yes. Well, happy 5-year anniversary to you. Do I owe you a gift made of like bronze or something, or is this wood?
You know, if you just give me a piece of cardboard with some kind of dried macaroni glued on it, I'll allow it. I'll hang it on my fridge.
Like a microwave with a heart around it?
Or exactly.
A microphone.
a microwave, too. That's
yeah,
fine.
A microwave, you know, sure.
I am hungry usually when we record, so it's appropriate. So, little backstory here. 5 years ago, exactly as we were recording this, Brian and I sat down in front of the mic and did a test show. So, not the official first show, which, by the way, we don't even consider our official first show our official first show anymore. We don't consider our official first, like, 15 shows our official first shows anymore.
Yeah, those were, what do you call that? Like, before a talk show, usually there's like a week where they'll do the talk show before it actually goes to air, you know, when there's a new host. It's
or if you're me, I think of it like the dream season on Dallas, where, you know, about 20 episodes in, I woke up found Brian in the shower, but I don't like where this metaphor is going. Never mind. But anyway, yeah, so you and I, we did like a test show, and we were like, can we stand talking to each other for 90 minutes? And it's worked out okay.
It has not proven a problem. Yeah, sometimes we've gone longer.
Not insofar. So knock on wood that this episode is not the one where we're like, F you, screw this.
Click. That would be so perfect.
Hang up Skype, you know.
Yeah.
But hey, lots of stuff to talk about. And I've still not seen Baby Driver. This is.
Don't worry, I saw it again for you.
Oh, okay. So you've seen it three times now.
Did I already mention it twice? Yeah, no, I've only seen it twice. Saw it twice.
Okay. So one for you, one for me. Okay, yeah. Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you have seen?
I saw The Big Sick, which I believe is going wide this weekend, which is what this July 15th.
Yeah,
and it's you know
I keep hearing how good this is. I'm almost like worried to watch it now because I feel like it's getting enveloped by the hype a little bit.
Well, I think I'll put it in a place that you'll be happy with. I think you will enjoy it, and I think most people will enjoy this movie. It's the way that I first heard about it was a Judd Apatow thing, but it turns out he didn't direct it and he didn't even write it. It was written by Kumail Nanjiani, who is from Silicon Valley, who was great on that show. I've always really liked him. And Emily Gordon, who is his real life wife, and this is their story. And so they wrote it together, and Michael Showalter directed it, and Judd Apatow produced it. So it's like, I don't want to give much away because I actually didn't know a whole lot about the plot going into it, which is kind of a nice way to do it. It's the IMDb description is a couple deals with their cultural differences as their relationship grows. And I will say that there's a lot more to it than that.
Okay, fair enough.
But it involves her parents, who are played by Holly Hunter and Ray Romano, and how they the relationship between them and Kumail. And
by the way, when you say her parents are played by Holly Hunter and Ray Romano, I don't know about you, but I like create comedy skits in my mind where I can just play both of their roles.
And you're probably on point.
But you want to date my daughter?
I don't know if you should be dating my daughter.
Dial her up to 11, and then your Ray Romano's pretty spot on. But like I really enjoyed this movie a lot. Like it's
okay.
I don't want to oversell it. I don't know if people are even overselling it, but it's just I don't watch a lot of romantic comedies. And when you do, they tend to have sort of beats that you can sort of predict or you know that are coming. They're a little familiar. And this one, I really had no idea where this story was going, probably because it actually happened. It was a real life thing, so it followed a few more unpredictable twists and turns. And But like I said, it's really more of a movie about his relationship with her parents, and I appreciated that a lot. Like there was a lot that of moments that felt very familiar to me just from my
your experience as a
life.
Pakistani man.
Well, just like moments that are comfortable, moments that are uncomfortable, and just this unique relationship that can that can happen. And I thought he's very good. Everybody's very good in this movie. It feels very natural style, but not in an annoying way. The only thing I'll say that I did not like about the movie is he has these friends that are comedians.
Okay.
And they are all insanely annoying.
Like, are they like sort of token characters?
Yes. They basically are played by real comedians like Bo Burnham and Adie Bryant. They're funny people in real life. Right.
They're just
so
riffing and
it.
They left in the riffing basically.
That's literally what it is. They're just like, here's my 2-minute scene and I am just going to riff the crap out of this. So it's like they don't even feel like real friends. They just feel like, hey, you know why you look so ugly? It's because of blah, 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 blah. It's like, dude.
To comedy interlude.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So I honestly would have like left one of them just so he looks like he has some sort of life going on. But otherwise, I could have happily cut them out. But doesn't take away from how good the movie actually is. So
I'm looking forward to seeing it at some point. Yeah, it's one of those things where you miss the press screening and then suddenly it's just like, when am I supposed to find time?
You know, and it's another one of those things too. It's like, I mean, you could look their story up. They're
right.
You know, this thing actually happened and whatnot, and it doesn't diminish from what the experience of going through this movie. And it, you know, this is like a perfect stream movie too. I mean, it's from Amazon Studio, so eventually it's going to be streaming on Prime.
Sure.
I think I'd recommend this to people that are looking for a nice.
Only because you're mentioning this, I feel like I should re-recommend to you if you haven't seen it. They Came Together.
Yes. Yep. I remember that. And that's one that I just keep forgetting about. So, yeah.
Yeah. And if you're listening and you don't know what that is, it's not a porno, despite what it sounds like. it's a parody of rom-coms starring Paul Rudd and Amy Poehler. But it features just a whole host of familiar faces. Jason Mantzoukas is in there and many, many others. And it's a very meta commentary on the tropes of romantic comedies, and it's not for everyone, but I'm fairly certain that you, Brian, would really enjoy it.
All right, yeah, I'll check it out.
Yeah. Also, actually, while we're talking about movies that are streaming, I saw a movie called Okja. Have you heard about this?
Yeah. What'd you think of that?
So this is directed by Bong Joon-ho.
Mm-hmm.
And it is it's a Korean American co-production. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal and what's her name?
Tilda Swinton.
Yeah, and the guy from The Walking Dead, who's not on The Walking Dead anymore. Oh my gosh, this is embarrassing. I watched The Walking Dead long enough. I should know his name is not Glenn, the character that he played on the show.
Steve Bennett.
You're actually not wrong. Steven Yeun. So okay. You're close.
Nice.
It's about this little girl who raises a giant mutant pig. and how she falls in love with this pig. So it's and this is going to sound weird, but it's a black comedy riff on E.T.
Interesting.
Kind of.
I didn't know the plot. I just was aware of
I mean, that's as I always say with a lot of these, especially these kind of smaller indie movies, it's best not to know anything about it. That's kind of the very rough framework for it. I enjoyed it. I don't, it's not something that particularly stayed with me, but I did think it was engaging while I watched it.
You did think it was engaging?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think there's worse ways to spend a couple hours on Netflix watching it, you know.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I was going to say black comedy E.T. You had my interest. Now you have my curiosity.
Yeah, so. it's funny because I went in not knowing anything about it, and so I assumed it was just fully Korean.
Mm. Oh, okay.
And then about, you know, maybe half an hour in, 20 minutes in, Jake Gyllenhaal walks in. And he plays this character who he's like Mr. Wildlife or whatever on like those nature shows on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So he's very exaggerated, and it's interesting to see Gyllenhaal playing a character, you know?
Yeah.
And then Tilda Swinton, kind of the same thing. She plays this spoiled, rich, like, scion of this company who's trying to build the company's name back up. And so, again, it's very interesting to see Tilda Swinton playing a character, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of different. Yeah, well, not so much Tilda Swinton because she's sort of chameleonic. But we tend to think of Tilda Swinton as very sort of dignified, and she's got that, you know? And when she strays from that, like, did you see Trainwreck?
Yes.
You remember Tilda Swinton was in Trainwreck, and, like, you don't even know that's her?
Yeah.
So this isn't as much of a complete transformation as that, but it's I would say it's outside of her usual range, you know?
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, I was out here in Los Angeles. They were doing, like, a week or 2 weeks of screenings at the New Beverly, and the director was there, and Quentin Tarantino was there for a lot of them, so it was kind of like a thing.
Sure.
And I didn't even realize it was on Netflix. So I thought it was like a thing. So yeah, I guess super easy to find then.
Yeah, yeah. And it's I would say it's painless. I mean, it's not as I said, there's worse ways to spend a couple hours.
Is it for kids? Like, would kids like it, or is it?
I would think so. You know? I mean, there's stuff in there like that by implication that's uncomfortable, but I think that you would have to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's probably fine.
Okay.
You know, I think the little girl is really good. The little girl who, you know, she's trying to get her giant mutant pig back. another movie that I saw that's out right now in a limited release is A Ghost Story.
Ah, really want to see this.
So this is an interesting one because it's the new project from director David Lowery, who did... before this, he did a movie a couple of years ago called Ain't Them Bodies Saints, which that's what kind of put him on the map for me, mm-hmm. which I don't know if you ever saw that.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it stars Casey Affleck, and it's kind of like a neo-Western, you mm-hmm. know, kind of a smaller profile thing, and it... Rooney Mara is also in it, Ben Foster. And so I had a chance to talk to David Lowery about that many years ago. And last year he did Pete's Dragon.
Yeah, which is one that I had heard was really good. And I just completely missed it. And I keep thinking of it too. Like, oh, I want to see that. But then I forget whenever I'm actually looking for something. So thanks for reminding me again.
Pete's Dragon is also on Netflix and absolutely worth watching.
Yeah.
And so David Lowery's really interesting voice as a filmmaker, and I think he's really on the rise, and I think A Ghost Story is a reflection of that. Also stars Casey Affleck, also stars Rooney Mara. And so clearly he's got, like, his troupe, you know,
mm-hmm.
that he works well with. And the movie, I don't want to say anything, because it's like, this is one of those things you just should just go in and experience it. I use this metaphor a lot on this show where I'm like, imagine a film school assignment where you're just given a prompt and you have to make a movie. So this is like, imagine a prompt where you have a couple that's in love and one of them dies. And this is about the person dying, dealing with the afterlife, right? So you get like Ghost
mm-hmm.
with Patrick Swayze, and then you get A Ghost Story.
Hmm.
Two entirely different, tellings of a similar story. I will say this: be ready to see somebody underneath a white sheet with black holes where their eyes would be, a la Charlie Brown.
Right.
For the majority of the movie, and deal with your impression of that image. You know, and that's what the film is. It's one of those things where. I really applaud it for being something really different. It makes you uncomfortable at times, not because it's depicting things that are particularly horrific or whatever, but because of it sets up these sedentary images and it just leaves them there.
Hmm.
So just to give an example, there's a scene in the film, and this is what's getting a lot of sort of mention and reviews and such, where Rooney Mara is eating a pie.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a pie that's been left for her, so she starts to eat it, and then she sits down on the floor and she starts eating the pie, and the camera does not cut from this medium shot of her sitting on the floor eating the pie until she finishes eating the pie. So we're talking about like certainly what feels like a 5-minute shot of Rooney Barnes eating a pie. Yeah. And, you know, it's on, like, literally, I saw people walk out of the theater.
Seriously? Oh, so yeah. It's, huh.
You know what I mean?
It's, But it's so funny, interesting. Something like that is either riveting in its own weird, unique way, or it's, like, testing you.
Yeah. And I feel like that's what this movie is. I mean it's I think it's one of my favorite movies I've seen this year.
Wow. The trailer made a huge impression on me.
Yeah.
So it seems like it'd be up my alley.
If you have a chance to see it, I really want you to see it, if only because I want to be able to talk about it with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So my point is, I actually had a chance to talk to David Lowery again about this film, and I was really excited. And as I say to him in the interview, my concern was going in about 15 minutes in, I was like, am I going to hate this movie?
You actually said that to him?
Yeah, well, I told him that. I said, my concern was that I'm going to hate the movie and then I have to talk to you about it. And he's like, well, I'm that's a normal reaction. And so we had a fun chat. So why don't we go ahead and play that?
So just to start things off, I thought of this movie, it almost felt like detox.
Oh,
after,
cool.
After doing, for you actually, I was thinking in terms of you go from a very big budget Disney production to this, and I was wondering about the process there, because when I watched Pete's Dragon, my interest in it was because you did it.
Yeah.
So that I was like, because, you know, I mean, I remember the original from what it was, but I was like, well, if Dave Lowery's doing Pete's Dragon, that's interesting, so I enjoyed that. But this, I didn't know what to expect. And for the first 15 minutes or so, I was like, am I going to hate this movie? And I was worried.
Yeah.
And then at the end, it's just seeped through my pores, and I've been thinking about it since yesterday, so that's something amazing.
That's a 100% valid response that was partially intentional, so I'm glad you had it.
Well, you mentioned this in another interview, and I can't imagine I'm the only one who's thought this up, but you see the image of the ghost, and my first thought is, I got a rock, you know, Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you know the iconography of that, so where does it enter your thought process where you're like, I'm going to take this thing that's comedic, and I'm going to turn it into something that's a vehicle for pathos and even terror? How does that happen?
That was the will to do that probably predates this movie, because I had the image in my head of a bedsheet ghost in an empty house for a long time. That's something I've wanted to utilize, and
In some way.
I didn't know what movie it would be or if it would be a scene in another movie. I found this recently. I was going through old screenplays that were all unfinished, and there was a scene where a bedsheet ghost shows up in one of them, and I was like, oh, man, I've been thinking about this for a while.
Why?
There's something very funny about that image. Yeah. It's very charming. It's got a naivete to it, all because of the cultural associations we have with it. But it's also incredibly haunting because it is intended to represent a person who has died.
It's
death. Yeah, it has a deathly connotation to it. And so there's this humor, but there's also this dark side to it that balances out that humor. And at this point, that image is so, it's been so instilled in our cultural awareness that we don't really think about it necessarily as a ghost when we see it. Like when you look at your Snapchat logo on your phone, if you have that, which I don't, but I know that's what the logo is, you see a ghost, right, but you don't really think about it as a ghost.
Right.
And when you see this image, you don't necessarily think about it as a ghost. You just think about it as this image that is part of pop culture.
Right.
And I wanted to actually present that image, present this symbol, and force people to think about it as a ghost, as what it actually is intended to represent.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a good challenge implicit in that,
yeah.
But also, just looking at that image, it is visually very strong. It's a striking image. It's a very beautiful image, and there's a lot of humor in it, but it also has a great potential for pathos, as you said. And I wanted to see if we could get past the laughter and get past the chuckles and find all of the other meaning implicit in this symbol. So that was the challenge that I laid out for myself. That was the goal, and also that's what fascinated me about that image from the get-go, the movie, the story, everything that comes with it is all very sincere, but that all came second. Initially, it was just that image.
So I watched the movie, and one of the thoughts I had was, oh, this must have been great for Casey Affleck. He probably shows up for a day or two. It didn't occur to me that he's actually under the sheet. So how do you pitch that to him in a way that, like, I'm like, oh, you're going to be in a sheet for the whole movie. You're not going to say anything. I'm imagining Casey Affleck. What's your communication with him like, having worked with him before? Is he intrigued or is he confused?
He's intrigued.
Okay.
He is also very willing to engage. And the process of getting him on board this movie was as simple as sending him a text message and saying, hey, I'm making a weird movie in Texas summer. Do you want to be in it? He said, sure. And then I was like, you're playing a ghost. And he's like, sounds good. And then I sent him pictures of the costume a little while later and I was like, here's what you're going to be wearing.
And he's like, cool.
He showed up. He didn't not show up. And ultimately in the film, he's not in there in every shot, but he wanted to be there for the whole shoot and he wanted to play that character. And that was important to him, even though for all intents and purposes, we could have had someone else under there. There's half the movie, he's standing totally still and isn't doing much. And it could have been a mannequin. But, you know, Casey's the type of filmmaker. He's an actor, but he's also a filmmaker who really engages with an idea and wants to push cinematic boundaries and wants to experiment. And I think this represented a wonderful, you know, experiment for him to partake in.
And this is you were filming before he got the Oscar.
Well before it, yeah. Okay. I mean, Manchester by the Sea had played at Sundance, and then it was being kept under wraps for the fall. So he was sort of just in between at that moment. He wasn't making any other movies. He didn't have any promotional campaigns to do. He just was sort of hanging out for the summer with his family, and we stole him away for a couple weeks to make this.
So I wanted to talk about the aspect ratio, which I thought is interesting to me that you chose 4:3. And I noticed the rounded edges. What was the thinking there? Because to me, it was very, in terms of framing the shots, it called attention to it. And not in a bad way, but I just thought it was unique.
Yeah. It forces, on a creative level, it forced me to be much more deliberate in how I compose the images with my cinematographer, because naturally I think in widescreen. And that's just how I think as a filmmaker, because
I think that's how audiences
most think. People think about movies in a rectangle. That's just how you expect them to be presented and how I think about composing an image. But I always enjoy seeing movies, particularly modern movies, that use the Academy aspect ratio. There's something very appealing about it, about that boxiness. Gus Van Sant talked about it when he shot Elephant, and the way he described it always stuck with me. And he said that he likes the image because it towers over the audience. Rather than expanding and wrapping around them, it towers over them. And there was something about that, the majesty implicit in that idea, that was really striking to me. So I'd been wanting to make a film in that aspect ratio for a while. I wanted it to be the right movie. I didn't want to just use it willy-nilly. But this film felt appropriate because it's about a character who's trapped in a space. He's trapped in a box. And it's a very claustrophobic context, and the image I felt could add to that claustrophobia. It also was a wonderful challenge to try to break free of that claustrophobia when the movie starts to expand in scope, but it just felt appropriate. It also was a great way to let audiences know right out the gate, that this is not going to be a traditional film.
Sure.
If someone has gone to this movie not knowing anything about it, thinking that maybe they're going to see a traditional Paranormal Activity style ghost movie. Just going from the title. At the very least, maybe the aspect ratio will clue them in that this is kind of a little left of center. And then lastly, the rounded edges was a way for me to engage my own fondness for nostalgia and sentimentality, because it makes the movie feel like an old photograph or an old slideshow. And it also enforces the frame. It makes you more aware of that frame. And as a viewer, I like that. I like to have the images that I'm looking at contextualized. Sometimes I want to go see a movie and see an image that just feels like it is stretching beyond the screen. You go to IMAX and you get that experience where you can't see everything at one time because the screen's too big and the image is too big. That's a wonderful experience in its own right. But other times I want to feel as if I could reach out and just hold the movie in my hands. And putting the movie in this aspect ratio helped that, but then adding those vignettes on the edges increased the degree to which I felt like I understood what the frame was. It gives a wonderful visual context for the images that lie behind the proscenium, and that just makes my eyes happy.
And just the last question. Now, obviously, I'm not going to ask you what's on the note, but I will ask, do you know what's on the note?
I don't.
Yeah.
Rooney wrote something that I told her to make it personal to her, and I could have looked over and seen it. It wasn't like she was hiding it, but just on the day we're, you know, busy setting up the shot and then shooting it, and then we have to move on to the next thing, and she folded it up and painted it into the wall, and by the time that had happened, it was, you know, I never saw what she wrote.
Wow.
And she won't tell me. And she said she's forgotten, but I believe she remembers and just doesn't want anyone to know, which I love. I value and applaud her, you know, the fact that she wants to keep that a secret.
Well, I mean, I need to tell you just my own reaction. I just saw it last night. And as I left, you know, I was asked to give my take, and I said, I need to think about it. And in the 45 minutes it took me to drive from the theater to home, my wife said, "Hey, what'd you think?" I said, "I think I loved it."
Great.
So that's my actual
perfect.
Process.
I always feel bad for. I've done a few conversations with people who have just watched it. Like they walk out of it and come to talk to me, and I'm like, "It's okay. You don't have to like I get it. You don't have to know. You don't have to know what you think yet. I totally get it. So I'm glad you had one night.
I did, and I think it's fantastic. I really hope people
Great.
Will check it out.
Well, they seem to be checking out. So I hope it did really well at the box office this weekend. So hopefully. Audiences are up for the challenge.
Well, I think, as I said, detox at the beginning. I think in the summer season, I think it's what people need.
I need to go watch a double bill of this and Spider-Man. See Spider-Man and then watch this. Or vice versa.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Okay, so A Ghost Story is in theaters now. It's in limited release. As you can tell, I had a really good time talking with David. And I really think he's you're going to be hearing a lot more about him. I think that there's going to be a lot of chatter about A Ghost Story. I think it's one of those movies that almost begs to be unpacked. And as soon as it ended, as I say in the piece, I mean, I didn't know what I thought about it, but about 45 minutes later, I was like, I think I love this movie.
Wow. You know what's cool? I just thought of it right now as you're saying this. We complain a lot about how there really isn't much nuance in what movies are being offered theatrically. Like if you want to go to see a news story or you want to see a story about people, you have to go to these streaming sites or television now these days. But I'm just thinking of like Baby Driver, which I loved, The Big Sick, which I really enjoyed a lot. And then now you're telling me about Ghost Story. It's nice. Like these movies are finding their way, right? And
yeah.
They're being well reviewed and they seem to be finding audiences.
That's very true.
That's encouraging.
Yeah. Well, I think that the more we see sort of this franchise fatigue phenomenon, I think people will be seeking out new and different things. And the nice thing, by the way, you know, people ask if streaming and things like this is killing Hollywood. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that would a movie like The Big Sick have as many eyeballs potentially watching it were it not a streaming film, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, you know? Because that's, you know, I mean, that's the type of movie that people are more likely to watch at home than in the theater, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
But it's nice. I just saw, like, ads for it the other day.
Yeah.
And you get, you know, all those little blurbs from... So it's like there's something to that. Like that'll get in someone's head and remind them that they want to see it later. So that's a tough one for studios to figure out these days. Sort of like that shark movie, 47 Meters Below, I think it was called.
That's right.
That was supposed to be a VOD movie, but it was getting such good reception, I guess probably test screenings or something, that they put it out theatrically and it ended up doing like modestly well. So
that just goes to show. I mean, if you put something different and market it the right way, people will show up. I mean, they're not idiots, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you put something terrible, people are turning away from that, so it's a start.
Yeah.
You know? Speaking of something terrible, I wanted to segue to a listener letter that we got, and this is a comment that was left for us on Facebook.
Okay.
And this is from Marlene, who says, "Hey guys, your review of Transformers made me laugh out loud on numerous occasions. We saw it while visiting California at the actual Chinese Man Theater, IMAX and Memorable Theater, and came out of the theater thinking, wow, so fun. But as I was listening to you guys chat about it, about 2 weeks after seeing it, I realized I could not remember anything about the movie. Until I heard you ask about Anthony Hopkins' robot butler dude, then I recalled a few things. So I 100% agree with your assessment, as well you should, Marlene. fun ride with some fantastic action sequences, but 100% absolutely forgettable. But I want to see it again, if only to see Megan Fox 2.0's outfit changes. Love your podcast. Thank you for that, Marlene.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, it's been sort of like a side story of the summer, just seeing the fact that this Transformers movie has not just underperformed, but it has underperformed substantially.
I mean, we've said it every single review from, I think, the third one on, but they are just the same film over and over. And so it makes me wonder with Bumblebee, I mean, they have to do something different, and it won't be directed by Michael Bay, and they obviously are trying to kickstart this into a cinematic universe. So I'm curious if it'll even feel the same, if it'll look the same, if the action will even be the same, if they'll try to scale it down a little bit. I'm really curious. That's the one that's going to pivot this, potentially.
I mean, the thing is, of all the inopportune times to launch spinoffs is after the world has pretty much turned a cold shoulder to the franchise. Because, I mean, this new movie, I mean, it's so far it's made $102 million, which is, that's like how much, you know, the last few made in a weekend, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so worldwide, as of right now, it's at just over 500 million. Hmm. The last one made more than a billion. So let's say this one tops out at optimistically 600 million worldwide. That's a substantial shortfall.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's something where if you're Paramount, you're kind of shitting your britches a little bit because they have nothing besides this.
Right.
You know?
Isn't that interesting, though? We didn't like it. But this was, of the past couple movies, the ones that felt the most coherent, right? Like, straightforward.
I mean, you know what I mean?
Like, I do actually...
I think coherent might not be the word you're looking for, but...
Yeah, like, 4 angers me.
Sure.
Like, 2 and 3... Actually, 2 angers me as well. But this one, I was like, all right, I don't know. It almost felt like Michael Bay heard what people had said and tried to do his own version of cleaning it up a little bit, but it's just one of those things. Yeah, people didn't go. So if you fool me four times, right?
I mean, you can only
like the first one.
It's like you've got a big liquidy diaper, and you don't have water available. Well, your options to clean that up are. This is like a very specific parenting metaphor.
Yeah, clearly.
You know, but your options, like, they start narrowing pretty quick. And I think that's where we are with Transformers 5. It's just a liquidy poop filled diaper. You're welcome, Paramount. You can use that on the ads. Why don't we take a quick break and then we'll be back. Talk some headlines, Brian.
Cool.
Well, Brian, we are back, and we got some headlines to discuss.
Indeed.
So just to start things off, I want to pick up on something we talked about last time when we were discussing Spider-Man Homecoming, if you remember. That was our last episode, Brian. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, I was there.
Yeah. You're usually 50% present, so it's always a coin toss whether you remember what we say.
Huh? Oh, yes. So, apes.
So we were talking about the mid credits scene at the end of the film, and the question and this is a spoiler about Spider-Man Homecoming, but yeah, I just realized that. Do we want to, like, how do we do this?
Yeah, so anyone who doesn't want to have Spider-Man Homecoming spoiled, hasn't seen it yet, they can skip ahead, I would say safely about 5 minutes, and hop over that, and then go back and check it out after they've seen the film.
Okay, there you go. If you haven't seen Spider-Man Homecoming, maybe just skip ahead. But starting now. So the mid-credits scene has Michael Keaton as Adrian Toomes, a.k.a. the Vulture. He's in prison, and the Scorpion, Matt Gargan, is like, the word is, you know who Spider-Man is. And Keaton says, hey, if I knew who Spider-Man was, he'd already be dead.
Mm-hmm.
That's my Michael Keaton impression.
Yeah, I was like, sort of, when you started, I was like, okay, that sounds like kind of like Michael Keaton.
It's funny because he does have like this very distinctive way of talking. Yeah. You know?
I'm hearing it in my head. I'm like, he's sort of like, hey, if I knew who Spider-Man was, he'd be dead. Okay.
Like, he has I feel like if a comedian could master the Keaton impression, it would be like, mastering the Denzel Washington impression. Like, you'd have a nice little niche all to yourself.
Yeah. This is an untapped.
It is.
I remember there was some comedian that was doing Harrison Ford, and I was like, sure. I've never heard anyone do Harrison Ford before. And that is brilliant that he decided to be the guy.
That's going to be his thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so my question to you, Brian, was, well, is he saying, like, there were three options. Does he legit not remember who Spider-Man is because, like, he went through his thing, maybe got amnesia or something?
Yep.
Which, as I sent you a screen, like a panel from a Spider-Man comic, that's totally in line with what could happen in Spider-Man. Convenient amnesia.
Oh, that's right? Like such a familiar trope. Exactly. I wouldn't be surprised at all if any movie did that. That's just a thing that happens.
That's a thing. So that was one option. Option two was that he's keeping it to himself so that he can have revenge on him. Mm-hmm. And option three is he's not going to do anything. Like this is like his face turn, if you will. And so that was like, and I think, where did you land on that? I can't remember.
I thought that he was protecting him.
Okay.
I thought he had like a change of heart. That was my interpretation when I saw it.
So director John Watts has confirmed your reading of that. And here's a quote that he gave to Entertainment Weekly. He says, he gets a moment of redemption and he gets to protect Peter, even though Peter would never know. It's his way of saying thank you. You couldn't just rely on the tropes of the villain being a murderer and killing a bunch of people. He had to be redeemable in some capacity in the end, and that he believes everything he said, especially about his family. So it was really a fine walk to create a villain that still has that moment of redemption in the end. Those scenes with Toomes and Peter in the house where he's driving Peter to the dance, that right there is the reason for doing the movie. That, more than anything else, is what I was looking forward to, and I got to have a lot of fun shooting that stuff.
That was, like, the most memorable scene in the movie, I thought.
It is, you know, and you know, I saw the movie again after we recorded our last episode, and I really, really got to savor those sequences. And, I mean, really, you and I are both such, like, Michael Keaton fans, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? But he manages to make such a meal out of this without, you know, doing like a mustache twirling thing. I mean, the whole movie, you can just appreciate it watching Michael Keaton's performance.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. It's funny when he says that scene is the reason you make a movie, then you have to imagine the director, the actors knowing that.
Yeah.
You would feel this desire to put emphasis on it or to relish in it it would take a really talented people to realize that that's not the thing that is going to make this scene special.
Right.
You know, it's the restraint and it's the small things. And so you've got to appreciate the talented people knowing how to handle something as delicious as that scene.
And it's also funny because, I mean, the first Spider-Man movie from 2002 has a version of that scene where Willem Dafoe figures out
yep.
that Peter's Spider-Man. I mean, it's very similar. And I'm not saying this is better or that's better. But the fact that this new one now has to, like, it, you know, it knows that, well, there's a version of this scene kind of already part of the spider ether, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How do we make this different? And they did find a way to do that.
Yeah.
You know? So there we go. Question answered. Thank you, John.
Yeah, and how cool is that? I remember saying this with the whole Han Solo movie thing where, you know, these directors get fired and you're like, oh, I hope we hear the story in the next 2 years. And then you read about it 12 hours later in detail, you know,
right.
With this, we're like, oh, I wonder, you could interpret that thing several different ways. And then the next day you see an interview online with the director of the film. It's just the day and age we're living in. Like, all our questions are getting answered because the questions are being posited to these people through these websites and Twitter and whatnot. So we get the responses. It's kind of,
yeah.
There's the pluses and the minuses to it all, but this is kind of fun.
This is very true.
Yeah.
But what else do we got, Brian?
Well, director Matt Reeves has spoken out again. Well, and Matt Reeves doing the press rounds.
We'll be talking more about Matt Reeves in just a few minutes.
Correct. And he is going to be directing the next Batman film, The Batman. And so obviously he's getting a lot of questions about that. But news came out this week that He is going to be doing a page one rewrite on the script. And the script had previously been written by Ben Affleck, Chris Terrio, and DC Films and Jeff Johns.
Yeah.
So he's
taken over the directing from Ben Affleck.
Yeah.
He's going to rewrite the script from Ben. He's going to be playing Batman.
Yeah, he will. Yes. You know,
Matt Reeves. That's the next headline.
Put your money down.
Matt Reeves playing Batman.
Which is interesting because I wonder, you know, it's no small thing to write a script.
Yeah.
You know, it's not
sure.
I just bang out a Batman script. I'm Ben Affleck. And, you're going to throw this in the garbage and no one will ever see all the work we did? Okay. Like, that's like, I wonder how he took that.
Yeah, I wonder about that. I actually think it's interesting that he just said that. Like, that feels like a big, did he not realize that would be a bigger story than it is?
Or even, yes. I mean, his quote here that I see in front of me is, no, it's a new story. It's just starting again. I'm excited about it. It's going to be really cool. So you wonder, yeah, you almost feel like there should have been a, what they wrote was great, but we have come together. We're hunkering down. We've got
like, we're going to build on that and go on some other interesting, you know, like,
yeah.
See, we should be publicists is what I'm saying.
And it should be noted also that Affleck's original script featured Deathstroke as the villain.
Yeah.
And
played by Joe Manganiello.
Yeah, he was all set up to play it, but apparently he is not going to be in this new, quote, noir-driven Hitchcockian vision of Batman.
I do not want the Joker to be the villain in this. That's the only thing.
I don't
thing.
Want Leto's Joker to be the villain in this, which I cannot fathom.
Honestly, it's less about liking or disliking Leto's Joker. I'm kind of just neutral on that. But I'm just like, I just want something different, you know. Like, give us a villain we haven't seen before, you know.
I feel that for sure.
You know, because we're going to get the Batman versus Joker thing at some point in this universe. We keep coming back to this, but I truly do wonder if Ben Affleck is, you know, long for the cowl, you know.
Man, you know, we are fans of Matt Reeves. I think we've said it before. And I mean,
yeah.
Spoiler, like we enjoyed Apes. You know what I mean? Like the guy's got a vision. He's a talented director. So I really would like to see his version of Batman. And I would really like to see Affleck get the opportunity to be in what could be a really interesting Batman story. So I hope he sticks around.
You know what it is, Brian? I want Ben Affleck, sorry, to get to play the character he thought he was going to play when he signed on.
Agreed.
And hey, maybe Justice League will be that. I mean, that's kind of an unknown quantity right now, but it sure feels like he got a little bait and switch. That's what it feels like, you know?
I think
he was assured certain things, certainly when it came to Batman versus Superman, none of that really panned out.
Right.
You know? But like, as you said, we'll be talking more about Matt Reeves in just a little bit, but what else do we got?
Well, let's see. Oh, well, Avatar. We got what's if we're not talking about Avatar, what are we doing?
What's the purpose of life if we're not speculating about these never arriving Avatar sequels?
Well, Sigourney Weaver actually came out and she defended why there should, nay must, be four sequels to the hit 2009 highest grossing film of all time.
Yeah, that nobody cares about.
That's the debate, right?
Yeah.
I was about to go down that avenue again, but let's just go with what Sigourney Weaver said.
focus.
Yeah. Her quote was, there's a very good reason why it turned out to be four sequels, having read all four of them. I think they're absolutely extraordinary and worth the wait. These films are very much about the peril of this beautiful planet, and James Cameron is continuing the same themes of greed, callousness, and the corporations and plight of indigenous people. She's basically like, they're good, trust me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, it's, you know what's funny is it's not even, it's like everything she's saying, I'm like, you know what, I'm down, I want to watch that. I'm just like, do I want to watch 10 hours of that?
I completely agree. This is my thing. I don't hate Avatar. Avatar's fine, but like,
it's totally fine.
And I'm totally fine with Cameron making a sequel. I think we agree. We just don't want him. I mean, he's one of our best filmmakers, period. Yeah. And it's we would like him to do sort of like what Nolan did, right? He made a Batman film, then he made the magician one, Prestige. Then he made Dark Knight. Then he made Inception. Then he, like, I wish Cameron would follow that same model.
Yeah.
So his talents are being used to the best of his abilities. We like Avatar, but it's not something that we want our one of our best filmmakers to spend the next 10 plus years of his life on.
Yeah.
So that's my personal take, at least.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's one of those things where I'm genuinely curious, you know, will it be worth the wait, you know?
And honestly, I mean, he's a smart guy, and if he's good, I don't think he's going to tell the same story four times. I think he's smarter than that. So,
yeah.
And Sigourney Weaver naturally is backing him up, but that I hope that's the case. I hope these are four very different films that just happen to feature the same characters. I mean, you know, we're optimistic over here. We're here's hoping. That's what we're saying, right?
Right. Yeah. So, that is that. That's the thing that's happening. Do we know, by the way, when Ava 2 is coming out?
It changes so much. I don't know.
All right, fair enough.
I believe principal photography has started. Wasn't that an announcement recently? I probably shouldn't say that. That's probably wrong.
it's
coming, I mean, folks. It's coming.
It's going to be 10 years at least by the time the next one comes out.
Yeah.
And it's like, man, I mean, like, just think about that. Think about how much happens in 10 years. And, you know, I mean, I'm legit curious. I mean, can you, because it's one thing to have no sequels, but you've got sort of a universe that exists in licensed fiction or whatever, something that's keeping the fires lit.
Mm-hmm.
This is nothing.
Well, it's got Avatar Land, right, at Disney?
Yeah, which, I mean,
I'm very, actually, I want to say it was Vulture.com. But somewhere, uh-huh, I had an article pulled up where it was like the story behind spending $500 million or on who thought this was a good idea, why did it happen, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I was really curious to read that.
That's funny.
Yeah. I have to imagine there were the people that thought it was a good idea who are thinking down the line, when these movies come out, this is going to get hot again. And it just happened. I'm sure they thought this would coincide with the sequel. I mean, it was supposed to come out this year, wasn't it?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. So now I'm sure there are some people shaking in their boots a little bit like this. I'm sure people are going to go, especially people who are at Disneyland or Disney World.
Yeah,
it's
like, what
going
are you gonna
to
do?
Be a spectacle to walk through and rides and whatnot. But I'm sure they're like, okay, come on. Like, give us the thing that's going to get even more people over here to want to be here.
You'll either go to Disneyland and visit it, or you'll see it from the outside if you're my family. This is a couple of years ago. My family and I, we were in SoCal, and we went to Downtown Disney.
Yep.
Which is, you know, if you don't know Disneyland, that's like the walk leading into the park.
Yeah, like restaurants and shops.
Restaurants, shops, etc. So if you want to go to Disneyland, I mean, you know, you have to hand over a kidney and give them the mortgage to your house. I mean, it's a whole thing, right? So my family, we went to Downtown Disney, and then the boys were like, oh, can we go to Disneyland? I'm like, sorry, guys, we can't. We turn around. So I only know about this because when they went to school, they had to write like what we did over the summer. So my oldest, who was like 8 at the time, he's like, we went to Downtown Disneyland. We went right up to the gate of the park and we watched everyone go in, and then we turned around and went home.
Like, oh. You gotta save that.
It's like the honesty of kids. My middle one, who's six, he just wrote a thing. Like, he had an assignment, like, what did you do over the weekend? And he had like a page, right? He's just like, I did nothing. I sat on the couch and did nothing.
Oh, man.
Out of the mouths of babes, you know?
That's great.
Anyway, Brian, do we have some Star Wars news?
Yeah, we do.
All right, well, let's cue the music.
Well, yeah. So in Star Wars news, we actually got new Star Wars content recently showing up on YouTube. I'm sure it's on some sort of official homepage, but I saw it on YouTube. But I'm talking about Forces of Destiny.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Yeah,
it's like this animated series, but they're shorts. I mean, they're about 2-3 minutes. and they feature the female characters throughout the seven films in these little mini adventures. Like, for example, Leia's in one involving, you know, the Ewoks, and there's what do I want to say? Padme. Padme is involved in one. Rey is involved in one, and it's interesting too because the majority of the characters are voiced by the actual actresses, right? So you have Jin voiced by Felicity Jones, and Daisy Ridley's back and whatnot. I think only Natalie Portman is the only one,
and well, and Carrie Fisher,
of course. But it's have you watched these?
I only saw the one. I saw the one where it's Rey meeting BB-8. Mm. I'm assuming it's set during the time where she first meets BB-8 and before they end up back at her place or whatever.
Yeah, I watched one where Princess Leia had the Death Star plans and she's like been taken prisoner, and then someone kind of comes to her aid. And I mean, these are very, very short stories, you know.
Yeah, and they have very simple animation. It looks like Flash animation.
It does, actually. It reminds me, actually, of the early days of Flash animation. It's one of those things. You know,
I don't think anything is essential in this from what I can see. It's just kind
of... No, I mean, you have to, like, understand who these are made for. And I've seen a lot of things written up about how they don't look very good and the stories are kind of...
They're made for little girls.
And, like, when you... I watched one and I got it. I was like, oh, okay, I get what this is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's hard to...
It's interesting, Brian, for me to, like, now that I have my own little rebel princess...
Uh-huh.
To be... I'm thinking... sort of with foresight, like, you know, I'm glad that she has characters she can plug into with Star Wars in a meaningful way, you know.
Yeah,
I just think that's
for sure.
Cool.
And I mean, these aren't very aggressive either, right? I mean, there's like action, but it's, to my eyes, it didn't seem like, you know, there's certain kids.
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, they don't girl it up. It's not like that SNL thing. Remember Chess for Girls?
Oh yeah. Well, and that isn't even what I was getting at. I just think, obviously, at school, like, kids have different, as they mature, like, tolerances to how much intensity they can take in, you know, TV and whatnot. And certain things affect people in certain ways. And obviously, Star Wars, I think, is going to be a big thing for children to want to get into. And I thought these were a nice, gentle entry into the Star Wars universe for people that aren't too
And the other thing, Brian, violent. Is that, I mean, they need to, because they are canonical.
Yes.
So they need to sort of fit in without upsetting the apple cart, you know?
Right.
So by definition, they're sort of, they don't matter.
Yeah, you know, but they won't know.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
You know. Yeah.
And actually, by the way, I mean, while we're talking about female characters, I mean, there's a story the past couple of days that I think is worth mentioning about this Rey figurine in Monopoly.
Yeah. Yeah, that
I thought this was kind of interesting, you know?
Well, yeah, because was that a Force Awakens specific Monopoly game, or was it Star Wars?
No, it was Force Awakens.
Okay, so, yeah, that came out, I guess, at the time of the film, 2015, and there was, you know, you have the pieces, the game pieces that are characters, and they had Finn, and they had, didn't they even have, like, Darth Vader or something random?
They had Kylo Ren.
Oh, maybe that's it. Yeah, I thought I read something where I was like, that doesn't even make sense. But they did not include Rey, and their excuse was, because people called them out on it, like, how could you not have the main star of the film,
right?
Is it just because it's this female character? And they said it was spoiler reasons was their excuse.
Which is bullshit.
Makes absolutely no sense, because there's nothing on her clothing that constitutes as a spoiler.
Like, if it's a spoiler, the only thing that could conceivably be a spoiler is Rey holding a lightsaber.
Right.
If that's something you're leading up to. Okay, fair enough. So give her the staff. Problem solved, you know?
Right. And I mean, arguably, I think she's a bigger character than Finn. So it's such
I mean, it would be, without exaggeration, it's like making a line of Star Wars figures, but you don't make Luke.
Yes, correct. So they said that they would correct it when they did a second, you know, release, what do you want to call it? So
like the next run.
I'm sorry.
Or whatever.
Yeah,
like a new production run.
But so they did, apparently, but not in the States. They only did it for like the UK and whatnot. And they did not, again, include the Rey figure. And they said it was due to insufficient interest.
By who?
Well, I wonder. It's weird that they did it at all, because when they say insufficient interest, it makes me think, well, yeah, I don't think too many people are interested now in 2017 in buying a Force Awakens Monopoly game.
Oh, sure.
However, They did make one. They did do a second pressing, and they did right. say they were going to do it, and then they didn't create it. So it's like,
yeah.
All right, guys.
It's, but you know what's funny is it's not just Monopoly. Like I got the Force Awakens Millennium Falcon for the kids, and that comes with BB-8, okay? Comes with Chewbacca, okay? Mm-hmm. And it comes with Finn.
That is so obvious.
Yeah.
It's so obvious.
You know, okay,
yeah.
So you're just trying not to have a girl figure, because obviously Rey should be, I mean, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That's just very odd to me. So, like, okay, don't have Finn. Have Han Solo. That would almost be
yes.
better, right?
Yes.
That would be less egregious.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, even though it sucks, maybe this is a good thing that had to happen for them to be called out on it and to be proven wrong and see that there was interest and that in the films, maybe they were even thinking, like, how will this film connect? Will people connect with a blah, blah? It's like, yes. Dummies.
Yeah, well,
you know what I mean? And then for the next round of, for episode 8, toys and
well,
whatnot.
it's kind of interesting because J.J. Abrams went on Twitter and he posted, you know how he writes on index cards?
Mm-hmm.
That's like his thing. And he tweets pictures of those?
Yes.
So he has an index card he wrote on, and it's on top of a picture of Daisy Ridley as Rey. And it just says, for those who are, quote, sufficiently interested, contact Hasbro customer service to get your Rey Monopoly token. And he gave the number.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I think it's pretty cool that he's out there. I mean, it's like a small thing, but I think it's an important thing. I mean, it, you know, it's a goofy thing for anybody to get hung up on, much less the people who are going to make money.
I know.
There are people who want to buy Rey action figures, and they're not just little girls, by the way.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm certain when I was younger and if I was buying Star Wars action figures, if I wanted to retell the story of Force Awakens, of course I'd want a Rey action figure.
Well, you know, I bought the boys the whole line almost of Rogue One figures. And I, for me, just listening to them play, they're like, okay, hey, I'm going to be Jin. Okay, you be Cassian. You know, and they're not like, oh, I don't want to be the girl. Like, you know, that was my worry.
Yeah.
And they're not doing that because that's how they're just Star Wars characters.
Yeah. So, you know? I mean, it sucks that it happened, but if it was going to go down the way that it did, I'm glad that people are responding the way that they are. And hopefully this will course correct moving forward.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, let's take a little break, and then we'll be back to talk War for the Planet of the Apes.
Aw, yes.
And we're back, and we're here to talk about some Planet of the Apes. Brian, this is my favorite subject.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a nice thing where we get to talk about it. Now, we are recording this on Saturday morning, July 15th. So it is the morning after War for the Planet of the Apes' official opening, and it seems to be doing pretty well. It's looking at a $57 million opening.
Wow.
Which would put That's it good. Below the previous chapter, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which opened, I think, at something like $72
million. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so a kind of a big drop. But I would imagine that the advantages it has is that the reviews have been really kind of extraordinary for a movie like this. But right on par with the previous one, actually, because Dawn of the Planet of the Apes also got really good reviews.
Mm-hmm.
But it cost less than the previous one.
That's astounding to me, which we'll get into.
the fact that they managed to... And that this is a Planet of the Apes tradition, where you spend less on the next one than the previous one. And so that could very well be the key to profitability. I saw the movie a few weeks ago, and I had actually told you via text. I was like, I need to watch it again before we talk about it, because so much time had gone by. So I was actually planning on rewatching it tomorrow morning, Sunday morning, with the kids. But I was like, no, because we were recording today. I was like, I'm going to see it earlier. So I went yesterday morning, Friday morning.
Oh.
So it is very fresh in my mind. And this is of course, the third Apes film. It is the close of this particular trilogy. Again, directed by Matt Reeves, did the last one. Again, written by Mark Bombeck, who wrote the last one. And again, depicting Andy Serkis as Caesar, as he just tries to do his thing. He just wants to be alone in the forest with his fellow monkeys, throwing poop, you know, leave them masturbating, one assumes.
As
monkeys are wont to do.
Yeah.
And then Woody Harrelson shows up and just mucks everything up.
Mm-hmm.
So you and I both really liked Dawn of the Planet of the Apes a couple of years ago when we talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming you know that I liked the movie. I have no idea what you thought of it, so I'm very curious. What's your non-spoiler reaction to the latest Is it the last? I don't know, but it's certainly the latest of the Apes films.
Well, I really liked it a lot. It's really cool, the trilogy that these films have become.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it really is all about the rise, and it's a great prequel. Like, you go into the original version, and it's just matter of fact, these apes are walking and talking, and I thought these movies did a really thoughtful story about how that could happen and what that would look like. I mean, it's one thing to know that they do eventually inherit the planet, but what is the struggle with, you know, humanity and their fight to not give that up, and how do they ultimately lose? And these movies are so much better than they have any right to be. Right? I mean, maybe that's not the right phrase, but I mean, they get the respect.
Better than you'd expect them to be, maybe.
Yes, they get the respect that they deserve. That this story warrants. And I was just really immediately at the opening scene, which I won't say what it is. We'll get into that later. But the opening scene involves a conflict, and it is handled in such a confident, masterful way. The way that it is, like, the sound, the visuals, what's happening. And I just knew, I was like, oh, we're in for, like, a film. Like, this is a
right
film.
Up top.
Yeah, like it's not going for, like, now we're going to have a boom, ba, boom, boom blast, and then we're going to have people talk for a while, and then there's going to be another battle. Like, this is a really, a lot of thought and a lot of care and a lot of passion is going into this, not just the story.
It's a character study that happens to be a character study of a talking chimpanzee.
Yeah, yeah, and in the non-spoilery aspects of it, I'll say, in the trailer, I did like the trailer, but when Woody Harrelson showed up, I was sort of like, ugh. Like, when I see Woody Harrelson, I like him, but he is Woody Harrelson.
He's Woody Harrelson.
Yeah, and I worked on that movie, Now You See Me, which he is in, and it totally works because you're like, oh, yeah, it's Jesse Eisenberg and it's Woody Harrelson. It doesn't matter who they are.
Woody Harrelson has a very kind of established persona.
Yes, and I worried because hearing him in his sort of very familiar drawl, delivery. Like, truly this become a planet of apes, you know? Like, like, I was worried it's going to take me out of the whole thing. And I was very surprised that was not the case. He felt like a character to me in this movie. Obviously, there are shades of Harrelson that you cannot deny, but they work in
his favor. Be his autobiography, by the way. I hope
shades
it's gonna
be. Of Harrelson.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought he was a really great antagonist. Like most great antagonists, you don't have to agree with, but you understand his perspective. They took time to actually make him someone where you can understand where he's coming from.
Yeah.
There's a lot of familiar characters that return that are great, but there's new characters that are great, particularly Bad Ape.
Oh, yeah.
Who is unbelievable. And that's the one last thing I'll say again without spoilers. Is the CGI in this movie?
It's next level, dude.
I was like, oh, we can do anything now.
Yeah,
like we're done. Like, we did it.
I mean, honestly, the CGI technology in this makes the CGI in the first one look like the makeup effects in the old ones.
Yes, it is astounding. It is astounding. Like, I never once thought I was looking at digital apes.
Yeah.
Never once thought about it. They are that good. And
there's just no seams left. I mean,
No seams. And it's just it's important. It's important to feel that way if you're going to really get invested in them as, you know, having souls and desires and wants and fears.
As people, quote unquote.
Yeah, I was going to say that, or humans or something. And I really couldn't say it. But particularly this character, Bad Ape. I mean, Steve Zahn / the artists who helped render him. I mean, it's remarkable.
It really is.
So, yeah. And then you?
So I liked it. You know, I told you on the show. I think that if I were to pick which of these three I like the best, I think I would probably pick the second one.
I agree with that.
By just degrees, though. I mean, I think it's not to me, this is not a situation where, I mean, you know, I've said before how for me personally, The Dark Knight Rises was a real letdown. this was not that for me. It was not, you know what I mean? I thought it was a very effective, emotional, and fulfilling trilogy close. I think in terms of set pieces and things like that, and some of the character dynamics, I respond more to the stuff in Dawn.
Yeah, the Caesar Koba stuff, that's what I always bring up when I think of that movie. Like, that was made a very big impression on me. So
And with that in mind, Brian, I mean, I'm glad that they kept Koba a presence in this film.
Yes.
Which isn't spoiling anything. He's not forgotten, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. I think that's important for Caesar's arc. You know?
Yeah. And I think you said what I was sort of trying to conjure up as a thought. And when you make a trilogy, the first movie has to accomplish one thing, the second one has to accomplish another, and then the third has to accomplish something else. And this felt like a good third film. I mean, it has to... Things have been set up. Like, we have to start already into the story, and then it has to wrap itself up. And I thought this movie wrapped up this series in a satisfying way.
Well, and I wouldn't even say wrapped up the series. I would say wrapped up this story.
Yes.
Right? Because I think that's actually what I really like, is the fact that clearly the universe still exists.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly there's room, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, the Planet of the Apes still exists.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how certain threads get wrapped up in this film. And so I hope that we do get more stories in this universe, you know?
Yeah. And I also, I just had made a note, like my impressions when I got out of it. This movie has... Like, it doesn't feel like a summer blockbuster. Like, it feels like a drama. Like, that's kind of how I think of this film.
Yeah.
But it also, it's very epic.
Yes.
It has a very epic feel and sort of scope to it. But at the same time, the story feels very intimate.
Yes.
And that's why I think I walked out, like, really, you know, it did make an impression on me. And I thought, whatever the filmmaker's goals were that they had written down to set out for this film, I feel like that they met them.
Yeah. Do you want to talk some spoilers?
Let's do it.
Spoilers.
So, you know, one thing I said at the very start of this series, you know, and I asked this to Rick Joff and Amanda Silver. I asked this to Matt Reeves when I talked to him for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I said, is this series bigger than Caesar? And what I meant by that is kind of what I was saying to you before. Like, you know, we've got 2,000 years worth of story available to us before it becomes the quote-unquote Planet of the Apes, like what we associate, the iconography that we associate with that.
Right.
So to me, just as interesting as Caesar's story is how we end up there, a lot of which is not going to include Caesar by necessity.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing for me that always was so fascinating is Caesar a tragic character? You know, and I think what I glommed onto is that the movie, to me, it ended the only way it could, which is with Caesar dying. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. I feel like about halfway through, I kind of plugged in to the idea that Caesar's not going to make it out of this movie. I don't know. Did that occur to you?
I wasn't thinking about it. I mean, I was just kind of wrapped up in it. But then when they finally got to their new home and he was dying, it just, I remember feeling without even conjuring the thoughts, like, this feels fitting. Like, I don't want this, but this is fitting.
And I mean, that's what's so interesting, right? Because the original script for Rise of the Planet of the Apes ended in a much darker way. You know, it ended with James Franco's character getting killed, and rather than sort of the way the film as it was produced ends with this uplifting thing of the apes ascending the trees and this crescendo of music, it ended with the apes climbing the trees and we're cross-cutting with sort of the fall of humanity and, you know, chaos, civil unrest and everything. And so, and it's going back and forth, right? And so what you end up with is a much darker portrayal of Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
And what the writers said to me at the time was they didn't like that because they grew to love Caesar. And they didn't want Caesar to be so dark. And with this film, you see the foresight of that decision.
Yeah.
Because the truth is that regardless of what else happens in the history of this universe, Caesar needed to die a hero to his people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like this is where the film ends, and Caesar dies, and the orangutan says, "You know, I'll make sure they know what Caesar did."
Mm-hmm.
Right, and in my mind, as sort of a fan of the franchise, I was like, I can see that orangutan being the ape's lawgiver.
Right.
And this is where the legend of Caesar starts, and you know, and so that's where me as a fan of the overall films is like, man, I want to see what happens next.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what you say, like the humanity, the pathos, let's say,
yeah, pathos,
that Andy that Andy Serkis brings to it. I mean, it's phenomenal. You yeah. know, when he's facing off with the colonel. You know, all of their scenes together are just magnetic.
Mm-hmm.
They're electric, you know?
Yeah.
I, you know, and as you said, I mean, Woody Harrelson is far more than Gary Oldman was in the previous films. I mean, he really feels like an antagonist. I mean, you
mm-hmm.
strongly dislike him, obviously, because, you know, he killed Caesar's family in the beginning. But beyond that, I mean, as you said earlier, there's still a window into his personality where you can kind of understand where he's coming from.
Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to agree with it, but we understand why he's so firmly where he stands.
Yeah. You know, when he's describing what happened to his son,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's sick. But yet we understand the construction of the character, and I think that really says something.
And then, I mean, we're in spoilers here, but his ultimate end...
Oh yeah,
Man, that was a moment. Like, I'm not going. I'll say this about the first film. I remember liking the first film, but I don't remember a lot of it.
Sure,
I do remember the second one pretty well, but this one, that moment's going to stick with me. I mean, with his whole, you know, mentioning that the simian virus that they have is still alive in all of them, and now it's slowly taking away their voices, which is like, oh, so that's why they can't speak.
Yeah,
in the original film, and then
exactly.
His just hatred for these apes and his just, you know, not wanting to become like them, seeing them progress and humans regress. And like, then when he loses his voice, I was like, oh wow. And he's got a gun. Like, I don't want to live. I don't want to live if this is what's going to happen to me. And it was,
And you, I mean, cause it's not just losing the voice. It's this progression into you lose your higher functions.
Yes.
So it's, I mean, imagine being in a situation where you're aware of that as it's happening to you.
Yeah.
Right? And then, and you know, you have to love the progression up to that moment, which is the little doll that he picks up,
mm-hmm.
which is infected. And had he not picked up the doll, that would not have happened to him.
That's fun. I'll be honest, I didn't even put that together.
Yeah, right, because remember Nova, the little girl, she has the doll with her, and it's got her blood on it.
Right. Oh, see, I thought it was just the slow progression, and he got it. I knew that they pointed the camera at it for a reason, but it just didn't occur to me.
Yeah, I mean it's like an O. Henry type thing, you know? It's like
wow, good pull, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's I really like that was something, and then you know the fact that now Caesar has to make a decision and he shows mercy, right?
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of Andy Serkis, I mean, again, like Caesar goes through a journey in that scene, you know, series of emotions, and they are all completely articulated. It's amazing.
Yeah. You know what's you mentioned how it feels kind of almost smaller scale in this film.
Mm-hmm.
It feels more intimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about that, especially having watched it a second time. I mean, there's a broader narrative that's playing out in the background of these films, which is the fall of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the story we're following.
Right.
And I just think that's so cool, right? Because normally, high-level stuff, this is where you're following the president or whatever, like as mm-hmm. this is happening. But the beauty of it is that we know where things have to end up, so we can sort of connect those dots.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like the idea of, you know, the title is almost kind of a misnomer when this is War for the Planet of the Apes, because, and certainly from the trailers, because the trailers lead you to think we're going to have like a war between humans and apes.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that other than the opening sequence, the war is not really between humans and apes. It's humans and humans.
Mm-hmm.
And the apes are just trying to find their, you know, place in the sun, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so that's a narrative choice that I think is so interesting, because it places you firmly on the side of the apes, and thus it places you firmly against yourself.
I thought about that. At the end, when all of the humans are basically wiped out by an avalanche, I think our theater applauded, and I was like, fascinating.
and that, too, I thought was so interesting, where, you know, the anti-Woody Harrelson forces storm in. And I think you, as an audience member, you're kind of, you don't know how you're supposed to feel about them. And then we have the moment where one of them sees Caesar and he points his gun at him.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's where you, as the audience, are like, oh, okay, we hate these guys.
Yeah, that was a good moment, because I didn't know, friend or foe.
Yeah.
Because they're against the guy that we don't like.
Right.
But they're all against apes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, that's the fascinating thing, because this story has to end with humans being stuffed and mounted in museums.
Yep.
So we shouldn't be okay with any of this.
How great was that shot, by the way? You're recalling it to my mind now. You know, I could see, and it wouldn't be wrong, but I could see a director showing that sort of wide shot of the people and then going to a close-up of the guy with the gun and pointing it up.
Right.
But he kept it on this sort of like wide slash kind of medium shot.
Kind of medium shot,
it was so much more chilling.
Yeah.
You know, because they all these faceless, because they're wearing these sort of snow masks. They look like snowtroopers from like Hoth or something like that. And they're all looking in one direction, and then they see Caesar and they all turn their heads, and then one of them slowly raises his rifle and you're like, ugh.
Well, and
so good.
And I think the fact that they are all faceless and mm-hmm. anonymous, we don't know who they are, and yet you can tell every single ape.
Yeah, they did. That was, I'm sure that took some thought and work, and it really paid off.
Like, you know, I went with my kids, and it was cool, because we've been just sort of mainlining Planet of the Apes stuff for the past like 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And my 8-year-old, he's like, oh, it's Rocket. Like, he knows who Rocket is. And, oh, look, it's Maurice. And I think that's so cool.
That is cool.
Like, even a little kid knows that, right? And that's, again, there's all these really interesting narrative choices that they do to really highlight the inhumanity of man.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I don't know about you, but that sniper, I think he's Hispanic, who Caesar frees in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I kept kind of waiting for him to like
be redeemed or something.
Be redeemed.
Me too.
Right? And it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting, that there are no human characters, notwithstanding the little girl,
mm-hmm.
who we sympathize with in this film at all. There is no Jason Clarke. There is no James Franco.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that's really, like, that's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's telling us something about how humanity is de-evolving, even while still being ostensibly civilized.
Yeah. There's I want to bring this up, and I think I can sort of tie it in here. In the opening, what I sort of teased in the pre-spoiler portion is that the Caesar and his people are living out in the woods, and they have their little camp or fort or whatever you want to call it. And then these soldiers are basically approaching.
Yeah.
And they're creeping through the woods all, you know, silent style. And then this battle opens. And what I really loved was the choice of how it was filmed. It could have easily turned into, you know, blam, 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 guns and close-ups and shaky cam. And that wouldn't even be wrong. I mean, it was like confusion, battle, what's going on? But instead, the camera does this really high up pointing downward shot of the people snaking through these paths, right? And it's, if I remember right, I don't even know if the audio is either like way, way down, the sound effects. It's just sort of like this music. And you just see the like blam, 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 the fire from their rifles all over the screen popping up in different portions. And instead of it being like a melee or an action sequence, it just becomes this haunting visual of this, you know, presence taking over. The apes just trying to peacefully live in the forest. So it feels completely different than what it could have felt like. And it really, I thought, made a huge impact. And helps you understand like the fear that these apes just living their lives out in the woods had to feel.
Yeah.
That visual, I was like, wow. Like, I wanted to watch it again.
Well, and Matt Reeves has said as much, that he was inspired by Apocalypse Now and things like that. And, you know, on one level you hear that and you're like, all right, sure. You know, that's the type of thing directors say. But you can, I mean, clearly Woody Harrelson's character is meant to evoke Colonel Kurtz.
Right.
And then, you know, the whole atmosphere. And by the way, let's circle back around and talk about Matt Reeves real quick. Because, you know, we've talked in previous episodes, and I don't want this to be like the pile on Michael Bay thing. But, you know, what I said previously was like, Michael Bay, I just don't think he has any particular affinity for this universe beyond the films he's made. And I said, you know, imagine if somebody who really loved Transformers was making these movies. One thing you can say about Matt Reeves, he loves Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm.
And he understands it. And both of his films are seeded with an awareness of the broader universe that they are a part of.
Yeah.
In very clever ways that doesn't feel, you know, the bad ape character wears this ribbed blue vest.
Right.
That is meant to be kind of a subtle homage to the vests that the gorillas wear.
Right.
In the original. And that's one of those things where if you don't know it, it doesn't matter. If you do know it, you're like, oh, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. You know?
And it's because such a thing, cute reveal, that moment when he comes out wearing his little
vest.
Yeah,
and he does a little thumbs up, right? Yeah, he was, you know, somebody compared him to Jar Jar. I was like, I didn't think he was Jar Jar. But I can see, I know that people, like, he's like a 50-50 character.
Yeah, I guess so. Because I liked him, I didn't even think about that.
You and I are both on the same page, but I know for a fact that some people thought that I think he was necessary, honestly, because I think the film gets very grim otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his presence really does. It's not him stepping in poop, you know. It's just very light humor just to lift the overall story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I will say I wish that this is like a weird thing to say, but I wish the moment with the rocket where he goes into the camp to try to save the little girl.
Mm-hmm.
I wish he would have gotten killed.
Mm.
Not because I don't like the character, but because I do like the character.
Right.
I feel like other than Caesar dying, the apes don't pay a heavy price in this one.
Yeah.
Though and his family, sorry. Obviously.
I do. I've forgotten the character's name, but I did. The girl, I think, was, some people are like, oh, okay, put a cute little big-eyed blonde girl in the movie, and it just feels like this sort of cheat or cliche or whatever. Sure. I actually thought she worked out really well.
And, she gave a really good performance, I thought.
I forgot the character's name, but the one that puts the flower in her hair?
Luca.
Luca. I thought that was very Brasi. Sweet. Because he's sort of a hard character.
Right.
And for him to show this gentle moment and put the flower in her hair, and then when he meets his end, and then she, with tears in her eyes, puts the flower in his hair, I was like, that just landed perfectly. This is amazing.
Yeah.
I really was moved by that moment.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, that leads into his death, which I think is more effective because of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Gives them these characters that can't even really speak, all these shades.
Yeah.
I
also, by the way, just picking up on what you just said, I also like that we're very gradually seeing the other apes speaking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, I like the idea of potentially picking up, you know, say 100 years down the line with a vastly different status quo, which lets them tell a completely different story that doesn't have to compete with these films,
mm-hmm.
But still carries the universe forward.
Well, with that in mind, knowing that we're hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years removed from the other film, what was your take on the girl being named Nova?
You know, it's funny because I read an interview with Matt Reeves where he's like, yeah, she's the one who Chuck Heston meets. I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So I just take it as, well, it's meant to evoke that without actually being that. It's meant to evoke that in the sense that we as an audience, if you know the original films, you have some familiarity with the character named Nova. So, you know, it's going to fire certain neurons in your head.
Yes.
And you'll have more affinity for her. I think saying that it's the same character, that doesn't make sense on any level, you know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of...
I was very curious. Like, the moment it happened, I think it did that. It fired off the neurons in my brain, and I was like, oh, cool, like making the connections. But then I was like, but that doesn't make sense. I'll have to ask Zachy.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't think these current films are meant to lead directly into specifically that original film. Mm-hmm. I think they're meant to... I don't think this is like Alien Covenant, where it's clearly meant to lead into Alien, you know?
Mm, interesting.
But I think it's meant to lead into something that is akin to that, you know? Mm-hmm. Like the iconography and things that we associate with it without specifically being that. But I've said all along, I've said since the first of these movies, I said I don't ever want to see them do a new version of that original movie, because they don't need to.
Right.
They've already got the best version of that.
Right.
You know?
And then lastly, I'll just say the score was great, of course.
Yep.
I didn't even know Michael Giacchino did it. And about like 20 minutes in, I was like, oh, I bet this is Giacchino. I'm beginning to recognize his phrases, musical phrases, or his accents or whatever, his traits. Right. And I was like, I guarantee this is Giacchino. And it was, I thought it was really good.
Yeah. Yeah. He does. The thematic material he comes up with for the little girl specifically and how that plays in,
mm-hmm.
is, it restates itself, you know, and that, like having watched it twice, I was paying attention to the music the second time, mm-hmm. you know? So that was something that I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to quote something that I read by Scott Mandelson, who does he does box office analysis for mm-hmm. Forbes, and then he's already analyzing the box office for this film just based on the Friday box office and how it's, you know, slightly lower and what that means, how it's playing closer to the first one. And he says, you know, part of the reason is that this is the bleakest big budget blockbuster since the second Mockingjay movie from The Hunger Games.
Yeah.
So possibly people just aren't in the mood for that. But, it, you know, he makes a connection, which I think is very apt. It feels a little bit like Star Trek Beyond last year, almost exactly a year ago, where really good reviews, but it didn't play at the higher level you'd expect, concomitant with reviews. But here's something interesting. I'm quoting him. He says, with rave reviews and a track record of quality, War for the Planet of the Apes is a rare franchise this summer that doesn't have to apologize for the last entry and or justify its continued existence.
Yeah.
Right? Unlike Transformers, Pirates of the Caribbean, Cars, and relatively speaking, the Spider-Man series, critics and audiences embraced the prior installment and presumably desired an additional sequel.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is.
that's a rare thing, sadly. But yeah, I think it's a very solid ending to this story, but I hope it's not the ending to this franchise. That's where I sit when it comes to War for the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, I concur.
Well, with that in mind, that's a good place to wrap up this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be back shortly talking about... I don't know. Dunkirk. We'll be talking about Dunkirk
in
our next episode. I'm looking forward to that, the new film from Christopher Nolan. And, of course, we do have some commentary episodes planned for this month as well, and those are coming up as well. Brian, anything you want to hype up?
Well, I'm currently writing over at a show called Puppy Dog Pals, which is over on Disney and Disney Junior. And I say you love puppy dogs or you have kids that love puppy dogs, I think they're going to really dig it. So check it out.
There we go. And as for us, you can find us at moviefilmpodcast.com as well as our Facebook page, facebook.com/moviefilmpodcast. If you have any questions or comments, send them there. Or our email address, moviefilmpodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter at Zachy's Corner. That's also my website, just added.com. And that's also my Instagram. I'm all over the place. And as I say each and every episode, I want to reiterate, please leave a review, leave a star rating at iTunes, let people know what you think of the show. If you are enjoying it, which we're grateful that you are, thank you so much for all the new listeners that we have. I'm glad to have you on board. But let people know what you think. Also, real quick, I want to mention the latest episode of the Nostalgia Theater podcast, hosted by me and featuring my guest, John Trumbull, as we spend about an hour and a half reminiscing about Batman the Animated Series on its 25th anniversary. I think you'll enjoy that one.
Yeah, I listened to it and I really enjoyed it.
There we go. It has the Brian seal of approval. So, with that in mind, this has been episode 125, 5 years of the Movie Film Podcast, woo! Brian, and here's to five more.
Yeah.
Five more after that, hopefully. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Welcome, friends. It's
It's the Movie Boom Podcast. Podcast, enjoy the show. Zachy and Brian are talking about the movie. Movie Boom Podcast on the radio.